It's the time of year when we're all thinking about goals and priorities. Now is the time to plan your next trip. Whatever kind of travel fills you up, whether it's lounging on the beach, connecting with family and friends, or going on a foreign adventure, Expedia has the tools you need to plan a great trip. Download the Expedia app or visit Expedia.com to start planning. You do need to be a One Key member to use price tracking. Signing up is easy and free. Expedia, made to travel.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
I'm Oprah Winfrey. Welcome to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. I believe that one of the most valuable gifts you can give yourself is time. Taking time to be more fully present. Your journey to become more inspired and connected to the deeper world around us starts right now.
It's hard to believe, but it's true, that The 12 Tribes of Hattie is Ujana Mathis's first novel. Its setting is Philadelphia. Over the course of 5 decades, this powerful book tells a story of Hattie, a strong, complicated woman whose difficult life takes its toll on her and her children. When I read it, the characters just leapt from the pages, and I knew almost instantly that this would be our next book club selection. Ujana Mathis grew up in Philadelphia, the daughter of a single mother, who instilled in her a fierce love of reading. By the time she was 9, Ujana began writing stories of her own. She says, words have been dear companions to her all her life. Eventually, her talent led her to the prestigious Iowa Writers' Workshop. It's an institution whose graduates include a multitude of poet laureates, Pulitzer Prize, and National Book Award winners. It was there in that storied place that she conceived and wrote The 12 Tribes of Hattie.
Well, thank you all for joining me. I am so happy to have our book club author, Ujana Mathis, here with us on Super Soul Sunday. So happy about this book. I think that I feel strongly that you're one of the next big voices. Well, you are indeed. And I can't believe that this is your first book.
Yeah, that's, sometimes I can't quite either, but it is.
And I started slowing myself down in the latter chapters. When I got to Belle, I started slowing myself down because I knew it was going to come to an end and I didn't want it to end.
The best compliment a writer can get, really.
Yes. I started reading more slowly and taking my time because I didn't want it to end. How did this come about?
I had been working on a completely different book, I thought. I'm sort of new to fiction writing, which is very strange. And I had been working on what I thought was going to be a memoir, a fictionalized memoir. And it was dreadful with a big capital D and awkward and strange. And I took it into, I had gotten accepted to graduate school, to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I took it into my first workshop.
The Iowa Writers' Workshop, where all writers wish to be accepted.
It's a really wonderful generative place.
And the whole point is to help you become a better writer.
Exactly. Yes. So you sit there, people have read your manuscript already, and you're silent while you're being workshopped is what we call it. So you're sort of taking notes, and everyone is making comments about your work and et cetera. And it's very humbling. It can be enormously fruitful in terms of being a learning experience. Can also be sort of devastating. It's sort of your heart kind of out there,
yes,
on the table, and everyone's sort of poking at it.
Your words, yes.
Yeah. So I brought it in. Feedback from my classmates was sort of middling, but fine. And then Marilyn Robinson, who was leading my workshop.
Pulitzer Prize winning Marilyn Robinson, Gilead.
Yes, Gilead, and Housekeeping.
Yes.
And Housekeeping.
Yes.
And so she sort of waits. She tends to wait until everyone's finished talking, and then she makes her comment. So there's a little silence because everyone could tell Marilyn was about to speak. And Marilyn said, well, it is true that the characters are insufficiently complex to the situation in which you've placed them. Now, insufficiently complex. Now, that might not sound that bad.
Yes.
But if you are a writer and I write entirely from character, that is sort of start to finish kind of what I believe, I really believe that I'm putting a person on a page, that is one of the worst things that you could ever possibly hear.
That insufficiently complex?
Insufficiently complex.
Okay.
And that is, Marilyn is ever gracious. And so she sort of puts things that way, and you kind of read into
you
it.
You interpreted
and you
go, that to mean not good enough, bottom line.
Yeah. Yes. And the characters weren't. They mm-hmm. weren't. They weren't fleshed out enough. There was something very superficial about the work on that fictionalized memoir. So I had a big kind of crisis about it, a real crisis, a kind of like, what am I doing here? Why am I at this workshop?
Like
I can't
ugly
write.
Cry crisis?
Oh, ugly cry crisis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Massively ugly cry
yeah,
crisis.
Yeah, yeah. For
a couple of weeks, even though I knew she was right, because she was
yes,
right.
Yes, yes.
And then I thought, okay, well, either I'm going to stay here and figure this out, or I'm going to go back to New York. And obviously, I wasn't going to go back to New York. So I thought, well, I'll write some short stories. And I started writing these short stories. And the first short story that I wrote was a kind of strange hybrid of the first chapter in my book, Philadelphian Jubilee, mm-hmm. and the last chapter, Sala. Very different from the way they appear in the novel, but a kind of hybrid. And I brought that into class, and it changed everything. Marilyn's whole sort of reaction to it was different. My classmates' reaction to it was different. And for myself, I knew that there was something right about it. It's not what ended up in the book, but I knew that I was on the right track.
That's why I love you great writers, because you sort of, you conjure magic through words. I'm fascinated that they just, you know, the characters kept appearing. And where are they? Where are they?
Are they in the ether?
They're in your head, obviously.
They're
coming through.
They're coming through from something. It's a very mysterious thing, you know. I've never been a writer that sort of talks about channeling things.
Yes,
you know, writers
yes.
will say, oh, and I felt taken over by the muse and I channeled. My writing process tends to be that every word is a horrible struggle. But when I look back on the work collectively, I will find phrases or sentences that I couldn't say exactly where that came from. And I feel sort of the same about the characters in general. I think Hattie is, my own grandparents were great migration people.
Yes.
And so Hattie is very loosely inspired by my grandmother. She's not like her, because Hattie is much sort of harsher and rageful in certain ways than my own grandmother mm-hmm. was. But certainly they share this migratory history, and they share also having been, I think, very, very heroic women.
So ultimately, this is a story of the great migration
yes.
of our people
yes.
from the South to the North.
Absolutely.
There was a period of decades where people were just, you know, my mother mm. and my cousins and my mm. aunts were all a part of that great migration
Something.
From Mississippi to Milwaukee to Chicago, exactly. you know, and everybody has family members that came. Everybody who's up here has family members
You're
who
down
were down there,
there
and at some point moved up here.
Yeah.
And that really is the story.
It's astounding when I think about, you know, I mean, people came with nothing. Certainly people were in different circumstances when they left the South.
Yes.
But there were so many people that came with an address scribbled on a piece of paper, you know, mm-hmm. a few dollars mm-hmm. in a pocket, enough food to sort of last whatever, however long the journey might have been. And these people refounded, they very much refounded a nation in the North. And it's astonishing.
You say on page 10, oh my gosh, you write like velvet. Hattie clambered from the train, her skirt still hemmed with Georgia mud, the dream of Philadelphia round as a marble in her mouth, and the fear of it a needle in her chest. And everybody who got off those trains, who got off those buses, I mean, I hadn't thought of it in that way before. And I'd, you know, read many stories on the migration, The Promised Land years ago, and that beautiful book that caused you to have the epiphany.
The Warmth of Other Suns.
The Warmth of Other Suns.
A thousand cheers to Isabel Wilkerson, who's
yes.
amazing and a genius. And,
yes, but when you think of it, mm-hmm. when you think of the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are coming up mm-hmm. from the South
yeah.
with this hope and this desire for a better life, and not really knowing what they're stepping into when they're stepping off those trains with their, you know, with their chicken sandwiches and deviled eggs in the box and mm-hmm. all that, you know?
Absolutely yeah. unfathomable. I mean, not to sort of wax grand, but I think it's appropriate. There's a Martin Luther King quote that says, the arc of human history is long, but it bends toward moral justice. And there is something about that bending and that mm-hmm. moral justice that I think speaks deeply to whatever it is that's inside us that is that is divine.
Yes.
And I don't mean necessarily divine. I don't mean it in a Christian sense. I don't mean it in I mean
divine.
Whatever. Exactly.
The bigger D.
With a big old D. Whatever it is.
That includes all of your religions and all of your dogma and doctrine and all of that.
Absolutely.
It includes it all.
Exactly. I often will just sort of simply call it humanity, which has come to be kind of a word that we sort of downplay.
How about life? I like life.
Mm-hmm. This mingled, strange, powerful, muscled thing.
Why did you choose? You're 39 years old. How'd you know about this?
I read a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think also a real sense of the past was mm-hmm. always very present with me. And I think partially because of my mother's age and because also my grandparents were quite old. They never talked about the South. It was never a part of anyone's discussion. But, you know, it's sort of in the ether. There's a sensibility about things that I think was transmitted to me.
Absolutely. It's the reason why in this amazing review in the New York Times, I mean, I would say... The
review is unbelievable.
Unbelievable. By Mishiko Kakutani, who doesn't like a lot of things. Yeah. And to get a review like this in New York Times, mm-hmm. I nearly wept for you. I was shaking when I was reading, like, okay, and then that paragraph and now that paragraph. But what she says about you, Ms. Mathis has a gift for imbuing her character stories with an epic dimension that recalls Toni Morrison's writing. And I know you and I both bow at the altar of Toni Morrison. And her sense of time and place in family will remind some of Louise Erdrich. But her elastic voice is thoroughly her own.
Wow.
Don't go anywhere. More to come after this short break.
No two travelers are exactly alike. And that means no two trips should be either. Texas' vast landscape of cultures, regions, destinations, and activities allow for an infinite number of different travel experiences. Are you a beach person? Well, you'll be having fun under the sun with Texas 350 miles of coastline. If you're more of a rugged vacation type, there are campgrounds, hiking trails, and state parks galore. And foodies can't get enough of Texas world-famous barbecue and Tex-Mex. Enjoy live music, visit internationally recognized art museums, and check out thrilling cowboy experiences. And now, Travel Texas offers a one-of-a-kind online trip builder that allows users to generate a custom, visually led trip matched to their unique interests. Visit traveltexas.com/get-your-own to get the only trip to Texas that matters, yours. That's traveltexas.com/get-your-own.
1 in 8, that's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. Who'll serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had. Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves. Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can help you grow from here or keep growing here.
Hi, welcome to McDonald's.
1 in 8, start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
Your mother, I know she's been a great driving force in your life. Tell us about her.
My mother is extraordinary. She's 79 now, which is wonderful and
one of the
strange.
Most read people you know, you told my producer.
My mother's incredibly well. She's better in the classics specifically. I think she's better read than I am. And she's just extraordinary. It's hard to begin to describe her because she's so particularly herself. She's a very moral person, mm-hmm. which I feel like the word moral has come to be kind of a bad thing, but mm-hmm. I mean it in the sense of a person who tends toward good.
To do the
really
right thing.
Really, honestly. Mm-hmm. And not only to do the right thing, but to think the right thing, mm-hmm. which is really something, you mm-hmm. know, because it's easy to sort of make a show sometimes mm-hmm. of doing the right thing, but to think the right thing mm-hmm. is really something. She was always extraordinarily encouraging of my writing. Like when I was a little girl, she was deeply encouraging. I grew up we had very, 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 very little money when I was growing up. When I went to high school, I was able to sort of test into a good high school. But when I was in elementary and middle school, I couldn't test into a school. So it was neighborhood schools or bust kind of thing, public school. And so my mother, I think, endured really a lot of sacrifices in sort mm-hmm. of living in neighborhoods where we couldn't really pay the rent mm-hmm. and was given the financials.
So she gave you what she
very
had.
Strong. Yeah. She gave me everything that she had mm-hmm. and what she had was an awfully lot.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into it because I know you don't want to talk about it because mm-hmm. you said you wrote a definitive piece in Glamour about your mother's, your experience with your mother's mental illness. I just want to say I know about it. So for everybody's like, why didn't you ask her? I know about it. Mm. You don't want to talk about it. I respect that.
Thank you.
I loved what you said about Lawrence on page 74. This is when you know who is going away with him. Lawrence wasn't a man who got hung up on ideals or lofty sentiment. He had lived pragmatically as far as his emotions were concerned. He had a car, nice suits, and he had only infrequently worked for white men. He left his family behind in Baltimore when he was 16, and he built himself up from nothing without any help from anyone. And if he'd not been able to save his mother from becoming a mule, at least he'd never been one himself. For most of his life, this had seemed like the most important thing, not to be anybody's mule. Hmm. I just think that young people reading this will get a sense of history in a way that perhaps maybe they don't know or have experienced. Hmm. Did you feel a sense, a great sense of responsibility in writing this because you knew that this would be another one of those books that would carry the story, the story, the great migration story, our story, our family story forward?
I did. I felt it's one of the ways in which also character comes in, mm-hmm. because once I really understood that this is what this was about, mm-hmm. I wanted to give these people as much sort of breadth as I possibly could. And I wanted to basically write a novel about the kind of pre-civil rights world with a post-civil rights sensibility. So the arc of the novel, you know, so you start in the 1920s and then you end in the 1980s. And one of the things that I had hoped to accomplish is that as the time moves forward and mm-hmm. as the characters get further and further away from the move from the South, mm-hmm. the sources of their problems become less specific to race, and though they are certainly informed by race, clearly.
Yes.
But they are also, they also begin to have these sort of wider kind of human problems. And that was sort of done on purpose, I think, because I wanted them to be, I really do think that one of the great scopes of the Great Migration, and also one of the great scopes of the civil rights movement, was for Black people, for us to have our humanity. And our humanity means that we do not have to be defined solely by race. It does not mean that it has to be a complete identity. It means Correct. That we are allowed a breadth and a scope and a largeness. And I hope that my attempt was that as the characters move further away, that their difficulties and strengths would expand in a certain kind of way.
Wow, you said that beautifully. Oh. But there's some people who are still even attached to it. You think you still have to be completely defined by it. Yes.
Yeah,
may I say, it is literature. So anybody who loves words and language will appreciate it. I was so stunned when I first did The Bluest Eye as a book club selection, and the multitude of women all over the world, all different races and colors, who responded to Pecola Breedlove's story. I thought it was just a Black woman's story, but it was really... Every woman's story.
Isn't that what great literature does?
And that's what
you know, that's what is wonderful about books.
Yes.
You know, it's what is wonderful about books.
The characters seem so real to me. I said this to you when I interviewed you for O Magazine. Mm. I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would say, God, I wonder where Floyd is. Is he out there? Is he, what's he doing? And then I'd realize, there is no Floyd. That's just a character. Okay, forget about that. Go back to sleep. You got into their souls. Mm. You really did. Where did that come from? How does one get into the soul of a character?
That's a very hard question. I think it has to do very much with intention. I think that one of the things, or perhaps the thing that I think is most important about my job as a novelist, if that is my job, which I now suppose I consider it to be.
Are you just now letting yourself feel that fully?
Sure, yeah, just now.
Yeah. Is you are a novelist.
I really think that I am. Like, I think that this is my life's work, and I'm very happy to have discovered it.
Wow.
But I do honestly believe it's my life's work. But I think that in terms of intention, what I understand to be my job is to put a real fleshed out dimensional human being on a page. And There is no other way to do that than to channel into that human being as deeply as you possibly can. I wouldn't know any other way to go about it. And my interest in creating character is to spend as much time as humanly possible inside their minds. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I can begin to understand them more and they can begin to seem full and real.
So they do become real to you,
yeah,
the characters, so. Just yeah, as absolutely. They become real to us.
Absolutely.
Us, yeah. The reader.
Absolutely.
Do they dictate what happens to them or do you?
It's funny you should say that, and we mentioned Toni Morrison earlier. Toni Morrison has a funny, I'm going to sort of misquote her, but she says something to the effect of, you know, at times you have to say to a character, listen, pipe down. I'm writing this book, not you. Uh-huh. I think there were sort of moments when I had an experience where I thought the character was sort of going off the rails or going into places where I didn't want them to go.
Inspired by Iyana's grandmother, Hattie is strong and mysterious and complicated, and her force is felt on every single page of this novel.
So I think also Hattie was a way to sort of imagine what my grandmother would have been like. And she was very hard to read, my grandmother. Very stoic.
So was mine.
Super enigmatic.
Yes. I love what the New York Times says. About she writes that Hattie knew her children did not think her a kind woman. Perhaps she wasn't, but there hadn't been time for sentiment when they were young. She had failed them in vital ways, but what good would it have done to spend the days hugging and kissing if there hadn't been anything to put in their bellies? I think that's essentially that generation, right?
Yeah, I think it is.
They didn't understand that all the love she had was taken up with feeding them and clothing them and preparing them to meet the world. The world would not love them. The world would not be kind. Mm. And that, to me, is the essence of who she was.
Really?
Yeah.
It really is. Because she's a deeply loving woman. She loves those children.
Yes.
And she really honestly thinks that she would be doing them an enormous disservice if she coddled them. And she also doesn't have time. She really is actually quite busy making sure that these kids don't starve to death or that more of them don't die.
Yeah.
It's everything she
and
has.
And I think there's a whole generation of people who were raised
absolutely.
That way.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And I also think that Hattie is very, I think we have a lot of stereotypes about what strength is.
Yes.
And we have a lot of stereotypes, particularly when we talk about black women's strength, you know, which is this sort of like iron-willed person who just plows through no matter what, who doesn't doubt, who isn't afraid, who isn't all of these things that are, of course, enormously human to be.
Yes.
And so I wanted this woman to be strong. I don't think anyone could deny that Hattie is very, very strong, but she's also deeply flawed. She's also afraid. She's also vulnerable. She also suffers from doubt. She suffers from so many things. I wanted to sort of grant her a kind of fuller humanity.
When you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member, you'll know a thing or two about an expertly packed capsule wardrobe that balances business and leisure. So you can go from conference sleek to cocktail party chic with a few new accessories. You can hustle from 9 to 5 before exploring with ease from 5 to 9. Because you're the chief excursion officer. The Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card. If you travel, you know. Learn more at go.amex/business.
The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
obviously, when you finish the book, you know what the 12 tribes of Hattie means in terms of this book. But where did the title come from? Isn't it biblical?
It is. It is. It's a direct reference to the 12 tribes of Israel.
Yes.
And I was very interested in these kinds of metaphors of delivery from bondage and things like that, because I think the book is a lot about nation building as well. Mm-hmm. And so that metaphor seemed particularly apt.
What was the first book you loved?
The first book that I loved, like when I was a kid
First book you loved. Then we can get to later. First book you loved as a kid.
First book I loved, I think it's a tie. There is A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle, which I kind of still love. And I read it when I was, I don't know, I must have been like 8 or something. And the other one is Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. And
I love that too.
So good. I just remember weeping. I remember reading it and being just sort of, just like my whole body tense, my entire, every muscle rigid.
Yes.
And then getting to the end and like falling out on the floor weeping.
Wow.
You know, I remember it very, very clearly.
I heard that happened to you after Beloved.
Oh yeah, Beloved did me in. Not the first time I read it, because I think the first time I read it, I was too young to really fully absorb and digest it.
You have to read all of her stuff more than
you
once.
Really do.
Yeah.
The first time I read it, I was either 18 or 19, I was really young. And I was reading it in a class. And I think maybe I was 20, it could have even been the third reading. I was in my early 20s and I kept having to put it down. And then when I finally finished it, I just couldn't get myself together. I think I cried for like 4 hours. I couldn't get myself together.
Yeah, that happened to me too. With Beloved, and also happened to me with A Known World, I think it is, by Edward P. Jones.
Known World.
I put that book down and that did that to me.
It wrecks you.
Those two
books, it's astounding in that sort of,
absolutely.
It in that way.
Absolutely. Oh, I love talking about this. Okay. So as a writer, writing this first time novel, what is it you wanted the world to know about most?
I wanted people to encounter a fully fleshed out Black humanity. That is what I wanted. That was what I had hoped for. Which is why I think that I keep going back to this whole notion of character, but why it is so important, or was so important for me, to tunnel in as deeply as I could into these people's brains and spirits, because they are just opened out and they become fully human and they have a full range of their humanity.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I hope that when people encounter the book, they don't sort of encounter a person with an adjective in front of them, but they, meaning a Black person, an African-American person, though of course they are that, but what they encounter is a full human being in the way they consider themselves to be fully human. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? We have a lot of trouble understanding people are as human as we are. What I wanted was people to encounter Black human beings who are undeniably fully human.
Mm-hmm. You did that.
Thank you.
You know, and you did it from the first page and the first chapter, because one of the things that I've said, using the platform of the Oprah Show and the magazine and my voice in any way that I could, that I've tried to express equally as you are, is that all pain is the same. And that when a mother loses her child in the middle of some country you've never heard of, she feels the same as you feel when your child is sick. Mm-hmm. She feels the same. And I think we experience that, you know, from the first page and the
Thank
first
you
chapter.
I hope that we do.
You did it. You did it.
It's also strange because in so many ways I still think of this book as my Word document. I really do. Like, it's my Word document. I have my tea and my sweatpants and my hair is all, you know, and it's my Word document.
Yeah.
Just it.
Not anymore.
No, it's not.
No, it's your baby out there in the world. What's your life like after all of this?
It's been exhilarating. It's been stunning. I feel sort of permanently stunned, you know, that if I'm trying to kind of compose my face because I'm on TV, but really my face would just kind of have these like enormous eyes, you know. A great deal of gratitude, a great sense of responsibility, you know. I think great sense of responsibility. I think it would seem to me that if one is given a gift like what is happening to this book, that one doesn't get the gift necessarily because one deserves it, but if one receives the gift, you have to go about the business of deserving it.
One does
afterwards.
Get it because one deserves it. I'm sorry, you do. You must accept it. One has gotten it because one deserves it. One has gotten it because one has written an extraordinary debut novel, really.
Thank you.
I know that you've read a lot of theology.
Yes. My interest in theology has very much to do with the fact that I think that one of the most profound ways to think about our sort of evolution, the evolution of human thought, mm-hmm. is to look at the evolution of our relationship to the divine and what people have said about it and written about it and thought about it.
I love what you say on page 236. Hattie believed in God's might, but she didn't believe in his interventions. Hmm. At best, he was indifferent. God wasn't any of her business and she wasn't any of his. Do you think that that's unusual to believe in God's might, not his interventions?
I don't think it's unusual. Well, it didn't seem unusual to me. There are not very many bits of Ayana in that book. I think that is one sometimes. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you that, but everybody asks that. Who are you in the book?
Exactly.
What character is you? I didn't want to do that, but thank you for sharing that.
It's, the bits of my sort of ways of thinking about things slip into people mm-hmm. at certain points, and that I think is one of them. I think... although it wobbles, my own kind of question of faith is wobbles back and forth constantly. I don't think that it is that unusual to think that there is a powerful, mighty being, but that doesn't necessarily have a sort of day-to-day interaction.
But I think that you had said to the producers that I think it's Thomas Aquinas that you thought had the best theory.
Oh, Thomas Aquinas has some very, very interesting theories.
Which is my theory too, that God is all life.
That God is all life, that God is all things.
All things.
And so that all things are imbued with the spirit of God, and therefore life becomes very sacramental.
Yes.
And all aspects of life become very sacramental. It's a really fascinating thing, and it's a fascinating thing too, because if you think about God being in all things, I grew up in the church, I grew up with a very religious upbringing. And when I sort of had my sort of refusal of the church, which happened when I was around 15, and mm-hmm. I was abominably behaved, you know, my mother mm-hmm. would take me to church and I would sit in the pew muttering about things the minister would say. It was horrible, horrible. And so then she stopped making me go because I was so badly behaved. But one of the things I think that was a struggle for me then, although perhaps not articulated, but it certainly is now, is that I didn't, it seemed to me that to be a person of faith meant that I had to deny reason and that I had to deny being a rational person. And one of the things that's really interesting about Thomas Aquinas is that if God is in all things, then there is also God in all of our human capacities, mm-hmm. one of which is, of course, reason, right? And so that
right.
we can approach God in some way also through reason, which is a really kind of mind-boggling concept and one that I find really lovely.
I was interviewing Rainn Wilson recently mm-hmm. here on Super Soul Sunday, and he said that there's no difference between art and prayer.
Hmm.
And when I finished The 12 Tribes of Hattie, mm-hmm. it felt like a big prayer, an offering.
Wow. Wow. I think that experiences, and I'm not necessarily talking about my own book, but just in the art and prayer thing, I think that encounters with a profound truth or something that is profoundly beautiful does feel prayerful.
Yes.
I think. You know,
this
happens
feels
in
poetic.
Music.
This feels prayerful. It feels intimate. It stirs something inside you that mm-hmm. makes you feel more connected to all, not just the characters, but it makes you feel more human. Mm-hmm. So thank you, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. Oh boy.
Thank you.
Thank
it's been
you.
An honor and a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Oprah Winfrey, and you've been listening to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. You can follow Super Soul on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week for another Super Soul Conversation. Thank you for listening.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. because...
Hey, listen, remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.